You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today on this Thursday afternoon. We're going to have a wonderful show ahead, and we're going to begin with the novelist and nonfiction writer Nicholson Baker, who's perhaps best known for exploring small things at great length. In his first novel, he explored the thoughts of a man as he rides on an escalator. However, his latest book is one in which he's taken on a much bigger topic. It's called Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. And in it, he examines the years leading up to the Second World War and questions the perspective that World War II was a, quote, good war. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it brings Nicholson Baker back to The Leonard Lopate Show. Welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
You begin the book with a quote from Alfred Nobel in 1892, so you begin even before World War I, where Alfred Nobel writes, "On the day when two army corps may mutually annihilate each other in a second, perhaps all civilized nations will recoil with horror and disband their troops." What led you to begin with that?
Well, first of all, I wanted to have the book have a kind of a feeling of an assemblage of fragments, and that the fragments would be spaced out in time in the beginning, fairly far apart, and then they would gradually become more concentrated as we got closer to the war. But there's what struck me about that moment with Alfred Nobel was that he's talking to the most prominent pacifist of the time, who was also his great friend. She had written a book on the folly of war, and they were very good friends. And he was trying to figure out whether his invention of this tremendous explosive, TNT, was actually maybe an instrument of peace. And what struck me is that it did several things at the same time, and kind of course, he was wrong. Totally, totally wrong. The idea of deterrence that has always attracted people. The more guns you have, the less likely there will be a war. It kind of summed up the mistaken idea that is true.
You know, as you talked about that and you talked about fragments, I hadn't made this connection as I was reading this book, but in a sense, that's what Nobel's work allowed as well, is the fragmenting of everything. Oh. That's what an explosion does.
Yes.
And in a sense, that's what you've done in this book, is it's not a narrative, but it's as you say, it's an assemblage of fragments. What led you to using that form for this?
Well, yes, it's pieces of shrapnel of probably the worst explosion of human misery that we've ever known and may ever know. Things went so completely wrong in the middle of the 20th century, and I think there's several ways, good ways to tell the story that I can't do. But the way that seemed truest was to concentrate on a lot of moments that were anchored to a particular day, and especially to a particular human decision, either to speak up against something or to shoot somebody or to make a speech. And I wanted each of those moments, which were possibilities or potential to do a good thing or a bad thing or a neutral thing, to kind of collectively tell the story indirectly, as if I were a documentary filmmaker and had a lot of clips.
Without the sonorous narrative voice pulling it all together that you often have in a documentary.
Right. This is one of those documentaries from the 70s, you know, when it was considered
the non-narrative.
Non-narrative. And I must say I love those because people's voices and what they choose to say can take you so much further than the narrator's interpretation. And although great historians create great prose, and they interconnect things beautifully, and they say, on the other hand, and yet, and they have all those wonderful connectors. But what if you just watched the war and suffered through this constellation of events without the connection, so that you, the reader, and I, the writer, have to make theories on the fly, figure things out, sift evidence. That piece doesn't connect with that. That contradicts. Does that maybe give you a fuller, a more complicated, sadder, felt picture of the war than if you have it all slalomed out for you by the historian.
One of the things you did here, as a documentarian does, is you probably sifted through much, much, much more material than you have put in these over 500 pages. Where did you begin your search for the material that you would then sift down and narrow into the book?
The search began really fortuitously in that I was responsible for a lot of bound volumes of old newspapers, and I began...
You took that responsibility on yourself, too. That was something...
It was a great privilege to have these things. My wife and I had them, and we would go to this big mill building we rented. They all came from the British Library, and we would open up. And I would open up this thing from 1941, New York Herald Tribune, one of the great papers, and read a headline. And I was almost invariably surprised. There seemed to be more on the front page than... what you would think of as the front page version of history. So I got to a feeling for the potential that was in the daily newspaper, and that's part of what drew me to write it. And then also I wanted to tell the story because I was in the middle of writing another book about a much smaller topic that was set in the war years partly, and I realized I had no real understanding of the Second World War, and I wanted to understand it the way you would if you were an eager student coming to it for the first time and accepting the fact that I'm not a professional historian, that maybe one of the things I could offer was my sense of outrage, surprise, shock that people who had been working with this material for decades don't have.
When you were growing up, was the war a subject of conversation? I know you've said that no one you knew was in the war, but was it something that people talked about with you?
Well, I have to revise that statement about no one I knew. So my father-in-law was in the Second World War, in the Pacific Theater. You know what happened? He turned into a pacifist. I mean, it's very unfair to veterans to say that they will all be uniformly affronted by someone who questions some of the decisions that were part of this war. I mean, these are people who saw things that we have not seen, and they have learned things about humanity that we don't know. I don't have that. But my parents were not particularly, as I was a kid, political people. I mean, they were kind of on the left.
Had they been kids during the war? Or
sure. My parents grew up during the war, but they were pretty young. And so they didn't want things to pollute. They didn't want people to be doing things in Southeast Asia, but but I didn't have a tremendously political upbringing. I also was the product of an American education, which meant that in high school, the high school I went to, there was almost no history. So I'm lucky, or maybe unlucky, in that I have only what I was able to grow in these. By doing the research that I did, to get back to my father-in-law, he was a medieval historian. He was a great believer that documents can open up and tell you things. And you can learn something from a will from 1320 that will just tell you all kinds of things you didn't know. And I wanted to look at newspaper accounts and diary entries in that same way and have them just open up and reveal their secrets and then move on to the next period. So that was my method.
One of the challenging things I know as a producer is often not what you include, but what you leave out. What was that like for you as you looked through all of this material? Did you make a conscious decision about the kinds of things that you were not going to tell?
One of the Winston Churchill doesn't come off terribly well in the book, but the irony is that it was always tempting to quote Churchill because he's so brilliant. He's so good at putting one word after the other. And the things that he would said were very revealing of his own state of mind. He was in a kind of manic high about being in the war. But he was also just brilliantly good. So in the first draft of this book, there was too much of Churchill's speeches. Even now there may be, to some tastes, too much of Churchill. But so I had to weed some of that out. I left out sometimes big events. You know, I this is not meant to be a kind of a comprehensive history of the war. This is meant to be something that you could almost imagine. You could almost imagine this being bound like those Victorian books would be bound when you'd have a blank space between each space. And the reader can go and add, fold in his or her own knowledge, which may be much more profound than mine. I found things that I think are surprising. I didn't know, for instance, that Herbert Hoover, Republican, would be a kind of strange moral figure saying, we've got to feed starving people in Europe. We can't have the British blockade keeping food from people in Poland. That was a powerful discovery for me. And so there's surprises, I think, in the book, but there are also plenty of opportunities for people to disagree entirely with maybe some of its implications, and also to add in their own knowledge.
One of the things you do in the beginning of the book is lay out very plainly that anti-Semitism was not something that was just endemic to Germany, that Roosevelt and Churchill had anti-Semitic statements and participated in things that were anti-Semitic. This is not a surprise to many people who look at the war, but perhaps it's not as well known as other things about the war. Why did you choose to emphasize this?
Well, one thing I didn't want to do was make some argument that, well, there are anti-Semitic statements over here in the United States, and there are anti-Semitic statements over in Germany, and therefore what happened in Germany is inconsequential. That's absolutely not what I wanted to do. The notion that that if two bad things happen, that they cancel each other out is just a completely counter to the method of this book, which is to look at each action and say, is that the right or wrong thing to do on that day? But I do think that that the context of that kind of genteel anti-Semitism that Eleanor Roosevelt had and then escaped from, much to her credit, I mean, she really did set it aside, and Roosevelt's own anti-Semitism, that created a context of tolerance for things that are or should have been intolerable. And the basic fact is that it trapped the Jews. Because when 1938, when the Germans did Kristallnacht and really spread terror in order to frighten out Jews all over Germany, the Jews were trapped, because Britain and the United States really wouldn't take them. And that's a terrible tragedy that is in part attributable to this much milder form of social anti-Semitism. German anti-Semitism is a totally different thing. This was a poor and lower middle class movement of skinheads who were indoctrinated from a very young age with the lurid kind of tabloid anti-Semitism of the Stormer, which was the thing on every street corner, all these stories about the evilness of Jews. These were kids who had grown up with that. That's a very different kind of thing. And yet the two worked together to create this catastrophe.
Do you ascribe equal weight, though, to those two ways of because there was, on the Americans' part and the British part, an unwillingness to accept refugees, but as you say, that's different from murdering people and taking their possessions.
Exactly. I think you have to start with the fact that there's that the fanatic kind of German anti-Semitism is the beginning of all of this, what we think of as the Holocaust. It's not that this book is trying to say that the Holocaust was really the fault of other people or something. It's still, you have to lay it squarely at the door of Adolf Hitler and Himmler and the people who actually did the terrible things. The uncomfortable question that kept coming up in my mind as I worked on this book, and I don't overtly say it, except once. I quote a historian much later, Shlomo Aronson. The question is, did the West's response to this horrific kind of German anti-Semitism, which was to institute a long, slow war based on a hunger blockade and these nightly attacks on German cities. Did that, in a sense, help Hitler? Did it solidify the nation behind him? The terrifying idea is, did the way we resisted the Nazi threat, did it actually help Nazis hold on to power rather than destabilizing them?
I'm speaking with Nicholson Baker, and we have to take a quick break. I'm Julie Burstein in today for Leonard Lopate, and we'll be right back with more. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Nicholson Baker, who has written a book called Human Smoke, which is from Simon & Schuster. Mr. Baker, in the book, you choose material that offer a lot of different perspectives about war that are true about the nature of war, how horrible it is. You illustrate with firsthand experiences of what bombings were like and what starvation was like. And you also show leaders such as Churchill and Roosevelt who, in the words that you quote here, have a passion for war, too. This is all not new. This is how humans work. I wondered what you were trying to point out as it, putting these things juxtaposed against each other.
Well, I think that you want to create some sort, in order to really understand anything, but especially something as difficult and important as World War II, you want to create, first of all, an anguished sense of what happened. You want to have in your mind some simulacrum in small of how horrible it was. So I think that that's part of the duty of the historian, is not to shirk that responsibility.
And individual personal stories, as you know as a novelist and we know in radio, are the way to bring that to
yes.
people as a way of understanding it.
And then also I wanted to ask whether, given that we feel these terrible things going on, and I go right through the 30s, it's not as if, you know, it's not as if things suddenly got bad. The persecution of Jews in the 30s is, even if nothing had happened in 1941 and 42, is so appalling that it's worth making the point that it was really bad already, and there was this simmering stew of antipathy that was rippling through German society, but then to ask. What Roosevelt and Churchill wanted to do was build 4-engine bombers. I mean, that was at the top of their list. That was what they wanted to do. Is that response, that militarized response of enlisting an entire country and turning it into a factory for building bomber planes, is that the right response to this kind of pathology that was extant in Germany?
Well, you write a lot and you quote Gandhi here. And in reading this, I had two thoughts. One is mm-hmm. Gandhi was lucky that his foe was Britain, which mm-hmm. jailed him rather than shooting him.
Yes.
And then the other was a question of that kind of approach at this moment. How can you imagine how that might have been?
Well, there's the question. You've got Gandhi, I think, was important to the book because he represents an extreme pole of pacifism. I mean, there's all sorts of gradations of this. The book is dedicated to British American pacifists who were, I think, more realistic than Gandhi, but also Nehru pointed this out in one of his memoirs about Gandhi. There's a kind of coldness as Gandhi aged that came over him, and he said things that you could, if you were feeling sympathetic, would sound saintly. If you're a little more skeptical, sound extremely cold, because he was saying, throw your doors open for the invader, allow your family to be slaughtered. I mean, it's an extremely disturbingly cold way of saying what I still think is worth listening to, which is submit physically to an invader. Don't say British honor demands us to offer up all of our citizens, men, women, and children, to the resistance. Submit physically, but don't submit mentally. I think that that is a reasonable pacifist way to proceed, and I think there were several junctures early in the war when possibly a moment of negotiation would have allowed the possibility of more moderate factions in Germany to push aside Hitler, and it's at least possible. We know that things worked out very badly, so we have to look at these counterfactuals and say maybe they would have been preferable to what happened.
It's hard sometimes, though, to look at what happened in France and say, well, they capitulated very early, but the Germans went in and killed many Jews and did terrible things. So how do you, the idea of not resisting, if you're someone like Churchill and you're watching what's happening in Europe, there's a kind of personal responsibility that one can take for one's own actions. But when one is a leader of a people, you're a novelist. Did you ever think about what Churchill might have been thinking about as he watched the rest of Europe fall to Hitler?
Well, I think the case of France is really crucially important. The first thing to say about France is, what happens when a country declares war? A feeling of xenophobia rips through it. What the first thing that the French did was put enemy aliens in concentration camps, and they were called concentration camps, which meant that people, mostly 80% of them were Jews, were put in prison by the French. So those camps that we think of as German concentration camps were begun by the French, and the same thing that happened in England. The first moment of the war was that Jews went to jail in England.
Well, these were the refugees from Germany.
Right.
But there were already marginalizations of Jews in Germany. This is not something
Absolutely.
That began in France
Absolutely.
Or England.
I'm just trying to make the point that the actual declaration of war shuts off borders, increases makes it almost impossible for people to escape, and actually creates a desire to imprison foreign elements within one's own country. So right from the beginning, you've got things that aren't right in France and in England. If you were Winston Churchill, you're actually, the first thing he did when he assumed the prime ministership was ask for a very large roundup of aliens and suspect persons. So the first thing he did, honestly, I mean, you have to face this. But
it's interesting because we know people in extreme situations do things. I found in reading the book that there was nothing here that surprised me, that these were all things that I knew. And the question is, how in a democracy do we wrestle with watching other people being killed? And the educator and speaker, Parker Palmer, you may know of him. He's a speaker. He's a Quaker. He has this concept about democracy that it embraces tension. It allows room for a variety of opinions. Mm-hmm. And he said that irrelevant idealism and corrosive cynicism are both equally damaging, that we must learn to live in what he calls the tragic gap between our ideals and the reality around us.
I think that's true.
And here, the argument by the weighing of one of the things I found is that if I had read this book and knew nothing about World War II, I might come away thinking that Churchill and Roosevelt were the ones who refused to make peace and were probably more warmongering than Hitler because of the weight of the evidence on their side and the lack of the speeches by... There are some horrible speeches by Hitler.
Well, I think that would be an unfortunate... I think you really have to look at Hitler as the ur-source of the evil that swept over Europe. You have to start with that. And I hoped that the other thing that's important to say is that we all, you and I, know that Hitler was a demonic madman. I mean, it's almost like you stipulate that. What you want now is your friends. You want to say, I trust this man. I want this man to act right. It's a deeply distressing and disappointing thing when someone like Churchill makes an offhand comment, you know, that a brutal comment. Well, I don't even have to quote it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's very troubling when our friends, our heroes, the ones we believe are the bulwarks of civilization, go wrong. And that's why I think it's worth pointing that out. I mean,
Is it a going entirely wrong? I mean, all of us have those dark impulses inside of us. Mm. And I guess we hold our leaders up to a higher standard than we do ourselves. But this is part of human existence. War is, and so is the darkness inside of people.
But Julie, I don't think that you or I would have thought that the right way to respond to what to the persecution of the Jews was to tell the Royal Air Force to fly over Germany and try to set fire to the forest, to the Black Forest.
I agree. Or to say we will not allow them in. I totally agree. Yeah. That would not have been a decision I would have made.
No, and Churchill is fascinating for that reason, because he is a warrior. He's a warrior and he's a believer in the British Empire, and he was not a person particularly interested in fighting on behalf of suffering people. It was not a war on behalf of the Jews. It was a war on behalf of a feeling. The interesting thing about Churchill is that he really hated Gandhi, I think, almost as much as he hated Hitler. He needed someone to hate. I think that's safe to say.
Well, he was lucky in Hitler then, because he had someone that was very easy to fight against.
Yes.
And you know, people elect the rulers they need for a particular moment.
Yes.
So,
But the question I think that it's worth really raising, and why I wrote this book, is, was Churchill, was Roosevelt the right leader for that moment? Was there another way to respond?
What would your way have been to respond?
Okay. I don't offer it in the book, because I feel that in some ways it's presumptuous, because I'm an amateur historian and all that. But I think that those moments when Hitler, for his own reasons, cynical reasons, said, I would like the British Empire to keep the British Empire and we'll keep Eastern Europe and all that, I think that the people in England who were saying, take that seriously, were to some extent right, because Hitler was a middle-aged man who was mentally unstable, and the only thing that could possibly have dislodged him was a more moderate faction that would have surrounded him and shunted him aside. The worst that could have happened is that there would have been 20 years of dictatorial tyranny in Central Europe. And meanwhile, if the United States and Britain had opened its borders, the Jews would have escaped. So I think there was a potential there at several points, early in the war, I'm talking early now, before the locomotive really got going, to do things that would have saved many lives and led to a better outcome.
In the book, there is a question about whether this was a good war, and one of our comments has just come in on our show page saying, is there a problem with the phrase good war? Because we all know war is hell. The question is, was it a necessary war? I know that many of the people who have looked at your book and criticized it, mm-hmm, have said, yes, the millions who died and the millions who survived the camps may have said, yes, this is a necessary war. But from what I'm hearing, you question that.
Well, as I just want to add that, to say in advance of saying, yes, I do question that, that the book is open to other interpretations. I don't think I think everybody is inconsistent, and faced with something as evil as the Nazi regime, all sorts of emotions go through your mind. But I do feel that it's worth questioning, even in this case, questioning the wisdom of the way that the West went to war. What happens in a long war is that there's a certain progressive brutalization that happens. And my book stops at the end of 1941, when in effect, it felt like the end of civilization. It felt as if to the people there that they were standing on the brink of something even worse. And I gave those two men, those two beautiful diarists, at the end of the book, Victor Klemperer and Mikhail Sebastian, both Jews, both observers, both resisting in the way that I think is the right way to resist, which is by bearing witness by writing something beautiful.
As long as you're alive.
As long as you're alive. Yeah. Those people have the last word, and they're looking at something even worse. And so the question is, did all these, this nexus of behaviors on the part of this kind of complicated dance of retaliation that was going on between Britain and Germany, especially in their mutual bombing attacks, was that likely to lead to behaviors in the civil populace that would allow for mercy, compassion, the kinds of things in an excitable country that we want to have paramount, that we want to have dominant? We don't want to have the emotion of hatred and vengeance dominant, because that's when terrible things happen.
Well, that's what we in civilization have set up all of our various institutions to try to overcome, is that bestial nature that is in all of us.
Right.
I'm speaking with Nicholson Baker. His new book is called Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. I have one last question for you. A few weeks before the current Iraq war started, on the show that I produced, Studio 360, we had Susan Sontag on. And she talked about the difference between World War I and World War II, and that in World War I, 90% of the casualties were soldiers and 10% were civilians. And in World War II, that equation was flipped. Mm-hmm. And in reading your book also, one of the things that became very clear is that the nature of warfare changed so dramatically. Mm-hmm. Is part of what you're talking about here, the you know, it's interesting, you talk about the diarists and that very particular experience, and then the pulling way back, if to bring back the analogy of a documentarian, to the very wide view of a bomber looking down, is part of what you're looking at, the nature of contemporary warfare with bombs and planes.
It is, but the uncomfortable thing is that that the decision, Undersecretary Cadogan in his diary wrote on a certain day, "Now total war begins." And it was after a cabinet meeting in which they all discussed the fact that they were now going to bomb the cities of the Ruhr Valley. Unfortunately, I think, because I feel that the British, I'm an Anglophile. I want the British to be the charming, witty, brilliant people they are. Unfortunately, they led the way with the bombing of civilian centers by night.
I've been speaking with Nicholson Baker. His new book is Human Smoke, from Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.